Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. The lesson from Jay Powell today, believe me, he as much as said, when I tell you flat out what the Fed is going to do. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, 26 January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, the thing about the Federal Reserve, which wrapped up a two-day meeting today, is that they really, really, really don't want to surprise anybody. Not banks, not businesses, and not the markets. And that is why this, from Jay Powell at his usual end-of-meeting press conference this afternoon, is honestly the biggest takeaway.
We feel like the communications we have with market participants and with the general public are working, and that the financial conditions are reflecting in advance the decisions that we make.
Financial conditions. Remember, we talked about those. Anyway, everybody knows what the Fed's going to do. Raise interest rates. Start selling off the $9 trillion in securities it holds. Probably in March. But, of course, Powell did add his usual caveat.
It is not possible to predict with much confidence exactly what path for our policy rate is going to prove appropriate. And so at this time, we haven't made any decisions about the path of policy.
Well, they haven't made any decisions, but you know. All right, a couple other key items from the Fed chair today. Number one, the labor market. We are pretty close, Powell said, to full employment right now.
The thing about the labor market right now is that there are many millions of more job openings than there are unemployed people.
But also on the not-so-good side.
I would not say that I would expect the supply chain issues to be completely worked out by the end of this year. I do not expect them, and I have not expected them.
Markets, for all that Powell says the Fed's communication strategy is working, well, those market participants didn't much care for what he had to say today. The reminders that the Fed is going to do what the Fed said it is going to do. My guess, though, is that the chair is okay with that.
The ultimate focus that we have is on the real economy, maximum employment and price stability, and financial conditions matter to the extent that they have implications for achieving the dual mandate.
Real economy, how people are feeling in their everyday lives. We talk about that all the time. On Wall Street today, traders kind of voted with their feet as Mr. Powell was talking, which was kind of interesting. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. He didn't talk about it specifically today, but Jay Powell has said in the past that one of the many indicators that he and the Fed rely on to figure out what to do with this economy is a quarterly report called the Employment Cost Index, which, as it happens, comes out on Friday, day after tomorrow. It's based on a survey by the Bureau of Labor Statistics of more than 7,000 companies that adds up the total cost to those companies of having people work for them. Actual paychecks, of course. Also, though, their health insurance, retirement packages, other benefits, all broken out by occupation and various and sundry other parameters. A veritable cornucopia of data, one might say, that economists and others just love to dive into. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has our primer.
The Employment Cost Index becomes especially important at times like this, when wages are shooting up.
This time a year ago, UPS was paying $13.50 an hour for people to work the night shift.
Michael Gritton runs the workforce development agency Kentuckiana Works in Louisville, home to UPS's International Air Hub.
Now they're paying $21 an hour. That's a huge increase.
And that's not the only labor expense that's going up, says Frank Fiorelli at small business payroll processor Paychex.
Retirement plan or sign-on bonuses, they're just having to enhance their benefits just to keep up with the big guys.
The Employment Cost Index takes all that into account. Plus, it can tell us whose wages in which occupations are rising more and less. Former BLS Commissioner Erica Groshen says right now it's important to know who's benefiting from the tight labor market.
We know that over the past 30, 40 years, we've had big growth in wage inequality. If we see more wage gains amongst lower wage occupations, well, you're seeing a narrowing of inequality.
In the previous Employment Cost Index report for the third quarter of 2021, total compensation rose faster than at any point since the early 2000s. Claudia Somm is a former Fed economist, now at the Jane Family Institute.
Macroeconomists thinking about what the Federal Reserve should do, they look at a big wage increase number and get worried.
That worry, explains labor economist Michael Strain at the American Enterprise Institute, is that more employees will demand higher compensation, driving inflation.
You expect the stuff you want to buy is going to be more expensive. You go into your boss's office and ask for a raise. And so your employer raises the prices it charges its own customers, and you see a sustained rapid increase in wages and prices.
The dreaded wage price spiral. But Claudia Somm argues that the distribution of compensation gains, more for low-wage and less for high-wage workers, should temper inflation worries.
This economy looks really good to the vast majority of Americans. It is the case that prices have risen more quickly than in the past. Wages at the bottom have risen even more quickly.
She says this can be hard on small employers who are being outbid by bigger competitors. Somm says when labor costs go up, businesses don't have to raise their prices in lockstep. They have other options. They can get more productive, invest in automation and AI. They can reduce their profits. But Michael Strain says the compensation hikes that employers are offering to compete in this pandemic economy are worrisome.
When you're talking about wage increases of the magnitude that we're seeing, about 4.5%, businesses have a really hard time dealing with that without increasing the prices that they charge.
Even if Friday's reading on the Employment Cost Index for the fourth quarter comes in high again, Claudia Somm won't see it as a sign of great danger.
Fed Chair Powell has talked about the high readings of the Employment Cost Index as a risk, something they're watching. But they're not going to raise interest rates because wage growth is high. What they're looking for is it to spill over into consumer prices.
And how will we know when that's happening? Ask an economist. Ask three. You'll get at least five different answers. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
One of the big, I don't know, bargaining chips, pain points, stumbling blocks maybe, of the negotiations that are happening over Russia and Ukraine is a natural gas pipeline that sits on the floor of the Baltic Sea that would double the amount of natural gas that Russia can send to Germany. It's called Nord Stream 2, and it's done. It's ready to go, but it's just sitting there, not full of gas, as everybody waits to see how everything shakes out. Marketplace's Andy Euler gets us up to speed on the geopolitics of global energy.
Since the building of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline was announced in 2015, German officials have called it a commercial endeavor.
For Germany, this is about a reliable supply of gas because they're getting out of nuclear and they want to get out of coal, so they need natural gas. So what's the problem?
Daniel Fried was U.S. ambassador to Poland in the Clinton administration and helped lead the West's response to Moscow's invasion of Ukraine in 2014.
The trouble with that view is that Putin regards gas as a weapon.
Currently, Germany gets up to 75% of its natural gas from Russia. Now, a lot of that travels through pipelines in Ukraine, which charges for the privilege. Chris Miller at Tufts University says, sure, Nord Stream 2 would let Russia avoid paying Ukraine, but that's not really what's at stake here.
I think it's wrong to overly focus on $1 billion here or $1 billion there in European energy markets. That's actually not a large sum of money when it comes to the global gas trade. And it's certainly not a large sum of money when it comes to what the impact would be of a vast war between Russia and Ukraine.
Miller says for Russia, these decisions are about geopolitics, never market efficiency. For Germans and the rest of Western Europe, more gas coming in would alleviate some strain on the energy market, and fuel prices would likely come down. Germany, like the rest of the countries in the Paris Climate Agreement, is trying to shift its energy mix. Christine Brezina at the German Marshall Fund says for years, Germans have described Russian gas as the least bad energy option. But now that political tensions are escalating, German officials have some decisions to make.
So the question will come down to how does Germany prioritize its climate goals, its nuclear phase-out goals, and its geopolitical and security goals right now?
She says where Germany lands on that list of priorities will determine whether Nord Stream 2 comes online or continues to lay dormant at the bottom of the Baltic Sea. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It could have been so much worse. We're so fortunate. The boats were intact and nobody got hurt.
Well, that's good, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials down 129 points today, almost 0.4%, closed at 34,168. Blue chips were up something like 500 points at one point. Thank you very much, Jay Powell. The NASDAQ gained 2 points, just a hair, basically flat, 13,542. S&P 500 gave back 6 points. We'll call that flat as well, 43 and 49. Today's AAA national average for a gallon of gas is up 1 cent over yesterday, now at $3.34 per. A year ago, the national average for a gallon of gasoline, $2.40, 90 cents lower than today's average. Highest price today, by the way, probably around the corner for me, right here in California, a whopping $4.63. Lowest, Kentucky, $2.97. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.87%. That's what Jay Powell wants to happen. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As you can tell, I'd imagine by the number of times we have mentioned his name today, Jay Powell's got a lot going on. Interest rates and inflation, of course, running down the Fed's balance sheet, the labor market, just a lot. And you can add to the list whether and how the Federal Reserve ought to create its own digital currency, a digital dollar, if you will. The Fed released a long-awaited report last week, weighing the pros and cons, didn't take a side, said it wasn't going to do anything anyway without Congress and the White House telling it to, but a digital dollar is on the table. So we figured best the rest of us get up to speed. Marketplace's Matt Levin is on the explainer desk today.
Let's say, hypothetically, you need a Mountain Dew and Slim Jim from the corner store to power you through the afternoon. If you're low on cash and use a debit or credit card.
If that bodega's lucky, he'll actually see the money in a few weeks' time, but not immediately.
Chris Giancarlo is head of the Digital Dollar Project, a nonprofit advocating for the digital dollar. He says in the future, with a digital dollar app on your phone,
you go into that shop, buy your Slim Jim and your Mountain Dew, you put your mobile device up to the phone, the store's reader, and money actually moves.
Instantly, just like cash, the bodega owner doesn't have to wait for Visa or Bank of America or Apple Pay to do anything or pay them any fees. This may sound kind of like Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies, which are digital, but the idea is a Fed coin would be as stable as that $20 bill you keep in your wallet. Todd Keister is an economics professor at Rutgers.
That's entirely different from a cryptocurrency, which is an asset. whose price, whose value in U.S. dollars is going up and down day to day, sometimes quite dramatically.
China already has a digital yuan, though it's still early stages. With more than 80 other countries exploring digital currencies, some fear not going digital could endanger the global dominance of the U.S. dollar. But there's plenty of skepticism on whether Americans at home would embrace this. Bill English is a professor of finance at the Yale School of Management.
I think in the U.S., people are a little bit more concerned about privacy, a little bit more concerned about what banks and others can see.
Still, English thinks it's possible a digital dollar supplants good old greenbacks. 10 years from now, if you bring cash to the corner store for those Slim Jims, they may even charge you an additional fee. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Talked a little bit about the labor market up at the top of the program, Powell and the Fed, of course. But there is some new data out from the Labor Department that shows just how much what kind of recovery you're having depends on the place you are living. Hawaii was hit early on in this pandemic when we all stopped taking vacations, but it also had the biggest year-on-year drop in unemployment from 10.3% in December 2020 to 5.7% last month. So we've gotten Manu Powers back on the phone. She and her husband run a boat tour company. It's called SeaQuest Hawaii. They're in Kona. Manu, it's good to have you back on.
Great to talk to you again, Kai.
So look, a couple of things I want to get to. But first of all, you had tsunami damage from this Tongan volcano?
That's correct. We had substantial tsunami damage, as a matter of fact.
Well, tell me more.
So we sustained around $100,000, a little north of $100,000 worth of damage. Yes. Yeah, that was my my feeling on the matter as well. We had no sirens like we typically do. Wow. And the notification that came from the county said, everything's going to be fine. These are going to be minor waves. We got a call from a friend who said, it looks like you may have sustained some damage in your office. So we sort of nonchalantly made our way down to the bay and then discovered our office had been completely destroyed with the exception of the structure itself.
My goodness. What does $100,000 mean to your business?
Well, $100,000 really hurts us right now. Omicron is hitting us pretty hard.
Yeah.
We're already way down. We're about at 30% of what we typically would be this time of year. So we're going to just very carefully try to build the business back, being as frugal as possible. Obviously, we're not going to be restocking all the inventory that we lost. We just found out today that we do not qualify for the FEMA threshold for money to help us build back. But they offered us an SBA loan, which is the last thing I want after COVID. You know, I'm up to here with SBA loans currently.
I feel you. But look, and not to take too serious a turn here, but every time you and I have spoken over the past year, and this is the third conversation, it's been, you are remarkably positive about the prospects once you turn things around, but you keep getting whacked. And I guess my question is, as a small business person who hasn't caught a break in 2 years, and you're one of a zillion in this economy, how much longer can you hang on?
It's a good question, as a matter of fact. When we first bought SeaQuest, we said to ourselves, okay, we've got a 15-year plan, and then it was a 10-year plan, and now we're down to a 5-year plan, and my husband and I are looking at each other going, we've got to get out of this business.
Yeah.
But you know, we feel really fortunate that we get to work together, you know, doing something that we love in a place that we just love so very much. And so you take the good with the bad. It just seems like over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of bad.
You know, it occurs to me that a lot of tourism-based businesses in Hawaii have been having a tough couple of years. I haven't heard of anybody else getting hit by this tsunami. Are you, like, cursed somehow or what?
Well, you know, when you put it that way, we really are the only business that took any substantial damage. There was a hotel down the street that in the lobby got flooded to a minor degree. You know, the carpets got wet. They had no business interruption. It really was just us. But again, it could have been so much worse. We're so fortunate. The boats were intact and nobody got hurt.
Omicron is one hopes on the downslide, certainly here on the mainland. How are your bookings looking in the next like 90 days?
Bleak.
Oh, really?
You know, January, February, March. Yeah, and it's really surprising to us, as a matter of fact, because right behind me in the bay here in Kona is the third cruise ship that's been here in the past couple of years. You know, we see some signs of a rebound, obviously, but the hotels are not full. And typically January and February are two of the busiest months of the year. So we're hoping to see some sort of meaningful recovery, some sort of consistency, because how else are we supposed to operate?
Yeah. Manu Power, she and her husband own and run SeaQuest Hawaii. Manu, we'll call you, a couple of three, 4 months. We'll see how it's been for you.
Yeah, and if I've got any good news, I'll call
That's
you.
That's right. You let us know. You let us know. Talk to you soon.
Take care, Kai.
We saw pretty early on in this pandemic, both because people needed to not be stuck in their houses or apartments, and because it was safer to be outside, and because exercise is good. We saw lots more people heading to the hills, out into the backcountry to go snowshoeing or skiing or hiking, too. And that's great, but for a lot of outdoor rescue groups, that has meant a lot more demand for their services. From Idaho and the Mountain West News Bureau, Madeline Beck reports.
About 30 volunteers gathered on a recent weekend at a snowy highway turnoff in western Idaho. They're here for a training exercise, so this situation is not real.
We have four overdue subjects. Not entirely sure at the moment how long they've been overdue, but we'll be finding that out from our law enforcement representative.
I'm with Scotty Perkins, a spokesman and volunteer with the Idaho Mountain Search and Rescue Unit. Today's scenario? Four snowshoers didn't come back when they were supposed to, so volunteers split into teams, check their avalanche beacons, and ski or snowshoe into the woods. Then, groups start locating missing snowshoers.
We're on scene with a patient, adult male, name of Hunter, age 25. Chief complaint is he is tired.
Some snowshoers are okay, but others in this fictional exercise aren't.
As part of our mission, we have some code words associated with the encountering of a deceased subject. And that's what we just heard.
Trainings like this help rescue teams sharpen their skills. That's important when more people are going into the woods as a reprieve from the pandemic. The Idaho Rescue Group had 39 calls for aid last year, up from 29 the year before. Part of the increase came from the weather. Cold snaps, but also hot days in the summer. A group of mountain bikers needed help when temperatures rose faster and higher than they expected.
It's happened to many of us, and one of the members of that four-person mountain bike team just found herself in a heat emergency.
Not every rescue team had more calls in 2021, but many teams did, due in part to a bad avalanche season early last year. That's according to the nonprofit Mountain Rescue Association, which works with volunteer teams across the country. Doug McCall, the association's president and a volunteer, says more people also sought out training.
We saw a huge rise in the number of people registering in our education base camp, either because they were looking for online training or, you know, they were looking to get trained before they went into the backcountry.
Rescue group volunteers often bring their own equipment for emergency calls and training. Other costs for things like websites and emergency gear and vehicles tend to be covered by donations, community fundraisers, and grant funding. Teton County Search and Rescue in Wyoming had more than 100 calls in 2021, compared to 80 the year before. But volunteer Cody Lockhart says that number doesn't reflect just how many people are getting out there.
There's a lot more people using the backcountry, and it's not proportionally translated into more rescues.
Lockhart says that may be because novices don't often take as many risks. Cell service is better than ever, and so many people are out there that it's easier to find help. But mental health has become a major issue.
That was defining for us this summer, as being part of these big rescues or searches for, you know, people that were despondent or struggling.
All of this means that volunteers need to be trained for a variety of things they may encounter as more people explore the wilderness. Chris Brookman is an 8-year volunteer with the Idaho Mountain Search and Rescue Group, and he directed the training off that snowy highway. He says that education is important.
We come out and we make our team better, and we're better equipped to go out and prepare folks to help people, as well as just we all enjoy doing this when we come out, and we like to play in the snow too.
After the training, a few volunteers planned to head out and go backcountry skiing themselves. In Boise, Idaho, I'm Madeline Beck for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. This started bubbling up earlier this week and now is a done deal. The Wall Street Journal reports and Spotify confirms that in response to a demand from Neil Young, the company has started taking the singer's music off the platform. They can have Rogan or Young, not both, Young wrote in an open letter. Rogan here being Joe Rogan, who's got a $100 million podcast licensing deal with Spotify, but whose shows are not shy about spreading COVID mis- and disinformation. All right, we are out of here, but not without your moment of economic context, of course. We told you about gas prices up in the numbers. And look, I know there's a lot of news, but don't sleep on oil prices, huh? The global benchmark topped $90 a barrel today at one point. Haven't seen that in a good long while. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.